Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
From MCIE.
Happy holidays, everyone. I hope you are taking some time to reflect on this year, the good and the not so good, and are making plans, goals, or dreams for a brighter 2022. My name is Tim Villegas, and you are listening to the Think Inclusive podcast presented by MCIE. This podcast exists to build bridges between families, educators, and disability rights advocates to create a shared understanding of inclusive education and what inclusion looks like in the real world. To find out more about who we are and what we do, check us out at thinkinclusive.us or on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Today, on this Best Of podcast, we are featuring four interviews. One that you haven't heard yet, Lou Brown, and three that you might have caught in our feed if you've been listening for a while, Katie Novak, Alfie Cohn, and Cheryl Jorgensen. The first is a previously unpublished clip from my 2019 interview with the co-founder of Tash, the late Lou Brown. I always meant to revisit this interview, and I'm so glad I did for this episode. Lou did not want to waste any time. Before the interview, he sent me a detailed outline of what he wanted to talk about, and in a signature Lou Brown move, the outline was in all caps.
How's the weather in Florida?
Oh, it's beautiful. Let's get going.
We start off by talking about how it can be impossible for educators who believe in inclusive education to find a job that matches our values and our credentials. And we finish with a discussion about whether Lou thought special and general education would ever become one system. Thanks for listening. And like Lou says, let's get going.
Well, Tim, when I started, there was no place for them to go.
Right, exactly.
You need a place to go. You got a place there in school. You got it. You know, right. The people who succeeded you got them in school, got them in with the tax support system and legal protections and safe environments and all of that. And so now you got to take it to the next step. Other people have done it, though, by the way. I mean, there are just thousands and thousands of kids with significant disabilities and integrated settings. I mean, but you got to do it. You got to figure out a way to do it. See, the other problem that you brought up that hit me early on when mm-hmm. we started training teachers is you get a practice teacher. You get with a good cooperating teacher. She gets trained and, you know, the best you can do in the time you have. And then she gets hired and she gets a job teaching. Then you work with her there. And then she does these wonderful things for these kids. And then they go up to the next class, to the next level. Nothing. Mm-hmm. All the communication devices you develop, the other new teacher won't use. The way you handle behavior problems effectively, she does the opposite. So just they don't know. This goes to that issue of ultimate functioning. Is what you want to do every year. You want to put people with quality servants. Every year you want to put people in the best possible environments and give them the best possible instruction. Every year you can't, you know, one person is always important, but you got to have a team. You got to have a longitudinal team. You built good horizontal teams, you know, collaborative teams. That's great. That's wonderful. That's necessary. Now you got to build vertical teams. Who am I sending them to? We had kids that were fully included in elementary school, but the middle school was segregated. So now, okay, then we came up with what we call elementary to middle school transition plans. And so we activated the parents to say, no, don't put a kid in a special class. No, don't settle for it. You're integrated in the fifth grade. You go to the sixth grade, you're integrated there too. We'll figure out the curriculum. So I understand where you are if you're there. And again, I think you're, unfortunately, you're the majority of the people in your situation. That's what's the status of special ed in the country for these kids.
Is, let's say you have a student with an intellectual disability who is being included in, let's say, a second or third grade class. And so some of the arguments are, well, this student would be learning so much more if they were in a homogenous setting with students like them who could work and learn at their pace.
Baloney. That's baloney. We know that's so untrue. Julie Costin wrote a great, and her group in Syracuse wrote a great paper. the promise of the special class. This is, and he get all this individualization, learn at his own pace, et cetera, et cetera. Be with his own kind. So, and you go and see what that happens in those classes. When we do a due process case, that's what I used to do more. That's what we do. We go see where the school recommends. Dead time, horrible models, isolated. I mean, no. I think our kids need functional skills. We can teach them in general ed and other ways. Our kids need social relationships with people with disabilities. You just can't teach them there. I want to build relationships at school that can be expressed during non-school days and times. You can't do that with the kids without disabilities. I don't buy that at all. And then you still got the same problem. What are you going to do about generalization? And what is it that's important that you can learn in a special class that you can't learn in an integrated setting? What is it? Specifically tell us. So we go see what they're doing in a special class. We can do that in a general ed class, but we're not giving up eating relationships, travel relationships, tutorials, and the best models available, and the best teachers in the American public school system are in those general education classrooms. We're not giving up them.
Right.
You see?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So I defy you. In fact, we've been well, that's what we used to do when you go to they won't let us videotape, because you go videotape dead time, kids doing nothing from minutes and minutes and minutes, and there's limited engagement. You got seven kids, eight kids, if you're a teacher with kids with autism in a segregated class. So you got two kids. No, you got a teacher and a paraprofessional and six kids. Now, how many get individualized instruction? How many? What are the other kids doing while you're doing that? You see, what are the role models they're exposed to? How much dead time? Time when nothing good is going on. So I don't buy that. I think that's an argument that's easy to refute. See, I think the best preparation is, and you're the inclusion guy, is learning not math, how to function in integrated society, how to function well without interfering with the achievement of other people, and outside the presence of people who are paid to be with you. That's what they need. That's preparation for that outcome. See, outcome, again, remember, is functioning in an integrated society. Live, work, and play in an integrated society, right? With the least amount of support. The more support you need, the more you're going to be kept home.
I think that because you said something interesting about learning without interfering with the achievement of others.
Oh, yeah. You want to do your work without interfering with the achievement of others. If you're a person with a disability and you interfere with the productivity of other workers, you're gone. It's not a shelter workshop where you can hit your head all you want. scream and yell all you want. It's hard learning to function in an integrated society.
Right.
It's so much more challenging.
So let's, so I just want to explore this for a little bit more. That is another reason, a big reason or argument that I hear when we're promoting inclusive practices, right? This student is so disruptive or has self-injury or has severe behavior challenges that nobody else can learn. Why are they in this particular setting? And I know that there's certain supports that need to be in place, but let's just for hypothetically saying this student is getting all the support that we can give him. There we're getting, you know, we have a behavior intervention plan, a functional behavior assessment's already been done. For whatever reason, this student is not doing well and is interfering with the learning of others. Where do we go from there?
Well, that what age you're talking about? See, it's extremely rare that if the kid's in the elementary school, that we can't solve the problem with the resources that are feeble. That little kids, little problems. Now you get older, you run into some heavy stuff, some important stuff. We have a kid who wouldn't take a shower, wouldn't get clean. God was tough, big, strong, tough guy. He smelled, and it was terrible. So we got him a non-school job at a dog kennel. Fit right in. We had a guy who was a flasher. He just in high school, he'd flash. He's, what are you going to do? And we had all this therapy and all this psychoanalysts talking about this and that. Oh, we got him a job in a butcher shop. No, no, you don't flash and it's cold there. Let me go back to the concept of increasing the environments. Some kids' school is a mismatch. You've got to get them into other respected integrated settings that countermand their disability, the problems they're manifesting. I'm sorry. We know a kid used to punch others, walk down the hall and punch others. We got him in a garage, a truck maintenance garage. Big, strong, strapping people, they don't punch them. Not a problem. You can solve more significant behavior problems with good matching, environment matching, than you can with all the behavior modification in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there are too many case history examples how kids with significant behavior problems, dangerous problems to themselves and others, have been solved by increasing the environments and that you give opportunities for them to function in.
Do you see a trend moving toward general and special ed becoming one system?
Yes. Go see Wayne Saylor.
Yes.
Kansas.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Swift.
Let Wayne do Rain a podcast. And there is no special ed. And do away with it. Put the kids in. The teachers have to be trained. Training a teacher for a special class is very different than training a teacher to be an inclusion support person. Dramatically different. You got to know just unbelievable number of things, important things. And so, yes, I see clearly the people that I talk to, more and more people say, let's do away with special ed as a profession and make education a profession and expand it.
How likely do you think that it will become one system?
I'm 80 years old, and before we started this interview, everybody said there'll always be institutions. Wrong. Or you can't serve all of these kids. Wrong. Or that they can't do real work in the real world. Wrong. I don't know if the special ed and regular general ed will merge. I think pool the resources. People are doing it. People are doing it. And doing it very, very effectively. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. There are a lot of things we used to have we don't have now that have gone away. But it takes time, people, resources, effort. I don't think I'll see it at my age, but I never thought I'd see the end of institutions, although I prayed, hoped for them, and worked toward them. I never thought I'd see all kids going to school. I never thought I'd see kids going to general education classrooms. But I saw it. It happened. I'm proud and happy to be a part of it, but it took a hell of a lot of people.
So Lou, what do you think? What do you think is the biggest barrier to inclusive practices?
Millions of people without disabilities don't know anything about us. Have no direct experience with us. They weren't on the bus with us, the school bus. They weren't in the bathroom. They didn't have lunch with us. They have no exposure. And that's one of the blessings of inclusion. You never know who's learning something, who's being changed, and who's being educated because they're around us. That's why I say, if we go to integrated settings in natural proportions with good support services, millions of the future citizens of the country are going to know about us, and we won't, they won't say, I don't want my daughter to go to school with somebody with autism, or don't invite them over to the house, they have Down syndrome. We won't have that. And when they become lawyers and physicians and teachers, they'll know about us. It'll be okay.
Next up is my interview with Universal Design for Learning expert Katie Novak. In this clip, we talk about how ineffective traditional assessments are because they are not universally designed, even though the most recent education law says they should be. Take a listen. You know, one of the biggest barriers that we're looking at as far as in the United States is standardized assessments and standardized testing, and accountability measures that you know, really tie the hands of educators. Is that something that you see, especially when you were assistant superintendent, educators saying, well, you know, I really would like to do this. It does sound great, but, you know, I'm accountable, you know, because it is reflected in my evaluation or, you know, my school scores, the scores that are sent to the state. And I'm not sure if I can teach this way. Is that a barrier that you've come across?
I've come across it, but I think that it's a barrier that is ripe for being challenged. What we're doing right now is incredibly ineffective. We have less than 40% of students in this country who are meeting grade level standards when you're looking at these like national assessments of education progress. So the traditional way is incredibly ineffective at increasing traditional outcomes. That is a fact. And so that's the first part. The second part is that these assessments should be universally designed. The Every Student Succeeds Act is very clear that state standardized assessments should be universally designed. They are not there yet, but I am hopeful that we'll be making more changes in the future so that what we're measuring aligns much more to the same resources and supports that we would have in college and careers. And the last piece is, you know, as an educator, the tests in many ways are inaccessible. I will not ever argue with that. I think that the tests are incredibly inaccessible for some learners. I think that they're also very focused a lot of the time on, you know, literature that aligns to dominant culture. So not only are they inaccessible, they're culturally not responsive in many ways. But that being said, I have a choice as an educator, as a school, as an administrator. I can choose to continue to teach in a really inaccessible way to prepare students for an inaccessible test, or I can choose to make sure that I'm teaching in a really incredibly, you know, accessible and trauma-informed and engaging and linguistically appropriate and culturally sustaining way. And I can make sure that the students have all of the knowledge and the skills that they need to have. And then I'm going to have them take an inaccessible test. Certainly, I would advocate for much more flexible means of measuring that information. I think that we are way too far into this universe and technology to not provide opportunities to listen to text, to not provide the opportunities to voice to text, because everyone will always have that available. So it feels a little bit to me like a game of like gotcha, and not necessarily what students need to be college and career ready. So long story short, I do not think that we are killing it so well on these tests that it gives us any reason to say, I can't do something different. You know, Beverly Daniel Tatum says, the work is not about intent, the work is about impact. Our impact right now is heartbreaking considering how hard people are working. we have to do something differently.
There's something I heard you say, I forget, it was in one of your videos, you said, when we value impact over intentions, all of us have equal opportunity to succeed. Could you expound on that a little bit? I thought that was great.
Yeah, I just think that in many ways, in education, we're focused more on our input as opposed to our output. So learning is alterable. All students can be successful given the right environment, given the right instruction, you know, given conditions of nurture. And we have to recognize that certainly there are things that we cannot alter, but there's a heck of a lot more that we can. And when we see that outcomes are not great, it's really easy to say, like, the kid's not doing their part, and saying, like, well, I did this, I covered it, I offered extra help sessions, I did this. And if the student is still not learning, then we have to work together to design something differently. And John Dewey wrote an essay called On Teaching in 1910. And he said, to say that you have taught something when no one has learned it is like saying you sold something that no one bought. Like, it's transactional. You know, you didn't teach it if students didn't learn it. But in many ways, that hurts like my heart and my soul, because people go into this work because it's emotional work, because they love teaching and they love kids. And it's heartbreaking to be doing the best you can with what you have and recognizing that you don't have the impact that you want to have. But that requires collaboration. That requires, you know, unlearning. It requires learning. And most importantly, it requires being evidence-informed enough where we're saying, when I do this, does it make a difference? When I do this, does this make a difference? So it's much more iterative than like traditional education was. Like, we can't design the lesson and then be like, yeah, I'm just going to follow it and see how it goes. Like, what are you going to do if kids aren't learning?
Right, right. And it's not enough to just say, well, you did the best you can.
Yeah. Moving on to chapter 7.
Right, right. But believe me, and I know that you've heard those conversations as well. Like, that's what happens is, oh, we'll get them next time, or we'll get them next year.
Right, yeah. Right. And again, I think that I really honestly believe the intention is good. I think that people are breaking their backs trying to do this. But we're not using strategies that are truly responsive to students, because in many ways we're doing things in one way. And the problem is any strategy that you use will likely work for some students, and they provide like a false narrative that what you're doing is really effective. Because if you don't truly embrace variability, and I say, okay, I'm going to provide you with this direct instruction, and then I'm going to give you a quiz, and some kids do well, it's like, see, they're paying attention. And it's like, but they're not the same. You know, we have very different, you know, cognitive skills and strengths and weaknesses and funds of knowledge and background knowledge. But it also starts getting into things like, you know, your mood can very significantly impact your ability to learn. And so, you know, even with, you know, the right background knowledge and the right ability to, you know, process auditory information, you know, if I'm in high school and I just went through a really bad breakup, my mind is not on your lecture. And so that is why we have to think about the barriers as not only being academic, but again, really thinking about how do we create opportunities for students to self-regulate, to find balance, to be able to understand and work through their emotions. Because, you know, students will experience trauma. Many students will really struggle with, you know, being really angry or really sad, and for really good reason.
My interview with Alfie Cohn, author of the book Punished by Rewards, was our most listened to episode of 2021, and the clip you are about to hear is probably one of the reasons why. Alfie, I mean, Mr. Cohn, lays out his argument for why educators should steer clear from using any extrinsic reward system in their classroom. Here's the clip.
I feel like I've read in an number of parts in your work where you talk about setting up the environment for learning. So is that not, you know, just antecedent strategies and another way of describing it?
No. I understand the confusion, but of course the teacher has a role to play in working again with kids, not just doing things for or to kids. to create a culture, a climate, a curriculum that will be most effective, but most effective at tapping and nourishing the intrinsic interest within the children that is the starting point of everything for everybody who's outgrown behaviorism and that old model that frankly wasn't even all that accurate in reflecting human experience, you know, 80 years ago. And certainly now cognitive science, the science of human motivation, has come way past that antecedent notion. Now, we now understand that there are different kinds of motivation that people have. There is intrinsic motivation, where you get a kick out of something and find it worthwhile, meaningful, joyful in its own right, and extrinsic motivation, where something extrinsic to or outside the task is sort of goading you or inducing you to do it, namely getting a reward or avoiding a punishment. Now, the research finds not only that those two things are very different, helping another kid or sharing my dessert with her because I think that's a good thing to do and she gets pleasure out of that dessert, is completely qualitatively different from doing it because somebody's going to give me a patronizing pat on the head and say good sharing or give me a sticker. But the research also finds that intrinsic motivation, the desire to help, to paint, to write, to do math, to clean my room, whatever it is adversely affected by any extrinsic inducement. So it's not just that those two are different. It's that, and the whole model that collapses the two and just talks about motivating kids and arranging the environment and so on in the behaviorist model is overlooking the fact that those rewards, including verbal doggy biscuits for jumping through our hoops, actively undermines the intrinsic interest that we're hoping kids will have and take away and want to continue doing good stuff even when there's nobody around to give them a doggy biscuit for it. This means that exactly like punishments, even if we euphemistically refer to them as consequences, rewards are not just ineffective for the long term and for the stuff that matters, they're counterproductive.
So would you say then for and we know a lot of educators who want to build strong relationships with their students, who want to survey and who are surveying their students about, you know, interests and passions, and that they desperately want to build up that intrinsic motivation.
Right.
So what I'm hearing you say is that for all of those great practices that teachers are doing, if they overlay on top of that, this idea, a behaviorist view, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's just a portion of how they approach teaching, that it could counteract or have a negative effect on what they're already doing that is good?
Yes, I'm afraid that's exactly right. So they don't do it to be nasty. They don't do it because they're stupid. They do it because they've been marinated in behaviorism in our educational system, which manifests itself in various ways, not only with garbage like PBIS and Class Dojo and red, yellow, green tags and other ways of treating kids like pets, but also with standardized testing, with scope and sequence top-down curriculum that breaks everything down into little bits and then offers, you know, reinforcement at each stage, like most versions of classroom management. And all of this leads you to do this stuff and assume that it's either necessary or innocuous or even helpful. So teachers with the best of intentions are pulled into becoming Skinnerians. But the reality is, every time you do anything like PBIS, any point system, stickers, gold stars, grades and rubrics, extra privileges and so on, you know, money, any kind of treat that's offered as an extrinsic inducement makes your job a little bit harder in the long run, because that much more of kids' intrinsic motivation has evaporated. And so, because this is really distressing to hear, if you've been, you know, brought, socialized as an educator to do this stuff, to say good job a lot, you know, good job, good job, good, yeah, I call it, well, never mind. It's something we do in a sort of knee-jerk fashion. And a little bit of harm is done every time we give that patronizing pat on the head, because it's an extrinsic inducement. So we tell ourselves, well, I don't want to do it forever, so we'll just give the kid a jump start, you know? We'll offer an extrinsic inducement at the beginning, and then we'll fade it out as the intrinsic interest kicks in and takes over. Unfortunately, the research overwhelmingly demonstrates that this is a fool's errand, that by virtue of offering the sticker, the star, the praise, the grade, you have set your goal back. Now there's more damage to be overcome. Now it becomes a little harder to restore, to revive, to resuscitate the intrinsic interest in helping, in reading, in doing whatever. And all of this is even tougher for teachers in the field of special education, where, as the late Herb Lovett, whose books I highly recommend on this topic, once put it, the only two problems with special education in America is it's not special, and it sure as hell isn't education. We find we ourselves in a position where we think, you know, with kids who don't have special initials following their name, you know, neurotypical kids or whatever, we wouldn't treat them this way. But with those kids, you know, you gotta treat them like pets. And of course, the research shows you're doing more damage as kids with special needs and challenges start out with the same curiosity about the world, the same connection to other people. But now it's much, much harder for them because of the sticker systems, the point systems, the praise, and all of that, which has systematically undermined the desire to do the very things we want them to do.
And finally, I wanted to share my interview with Cheryl Jorgensen, author of many books on the topic of inclusive education. This clip is from 2014, and it is important to me because it shows my growth in an area that I'm rather ashamed it took me so long to realize, the parallel between the civil rights and disability rights movement and how they are inseparable.
What often gets tied together when we talk about advocacy for people with disabilities is kind of the parallels between the civil rights movement and the disability rights movement. And so a lot of what, you know, the people that I know that are in the disability rights movement, you know, use that kind of language a lot. You know, I mean, we use segregation, right? I mean, that is a civil rights term. But there are, you know, do you see them as the same thing, or do you see them differently? The reason why I'm asking is, I've always seen it, I guess, in principle as the same thing, because you have, you know, people with disabilities and people, you know, of different races being discriminated against simply because they have, you know, those characteristics. But, you know, a Mexican, you know, which I am, Mexican American, you know, or a person with brown skin being discriminated against, and a person with an intellectual disability being discriminated against, or at least not being, you know, allowed, you know, quote unquote, to be in a general education room. They are inherently different because that person with, you know, brown skin, let's say if they're a typically developing person, is no different than anybody else in that classroom. But a person with an intellectual disability is inherently different, mm-hmm. not less, of course, mm-hmm. but different. And so what do you think about that in that conversation mm-hmm. And kind of comparing the idea mm-hmm. of disability rights and civil rights? Does that make sense?
Yes. I think they're the same. I think the differences that you pointed out, that it's sort of a different situation, discrimination against a person with brown skin is a slightly different situation than discrimination against a person with an intellectual disability, mm-hmm. is a matter of degree. Mm-hmm. Because I hate to say this, Tim, but if we surveyed everybody in the United States and said, among the racial groups, how would you rank them in terms of intelligence?
Yeah.
I don't need to finish the sentence.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
Now, people, it's in the last, it's become more unpopular to admit that.
Right.
And to say that, but you will still hear people who work in urban school districts say, just about kids of color, they just can't learn as much as those white kids. Mm-hmm. So I think they're some of the same prejudices about competence and ability mm-hmm. going on. There are truly similarities in terms of prejudice against groups that historically haven't had much power.
Mm, correct.
And,
yeah.
White people have controlled people of color, and intellectually non-labeled people have controlled the lives of people with disabilities, including children with disabilities, and have purported to say, my professional opinion is that this is what your life should look like, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I see them as very similar. And as we're still struggling with race in this country, and we're still not there after 150 years.
Right.
And only 60 years with Brown versus the Board of Education.
Correct.
So
mm-hmm.
when I say I wish we were further than we are with inclusive education, I sort of say the same really entrenched societal institutions that are perpetuating racism are the societal institutions that perpetuate discrimination against children and adults with disabilities are just as ingrained.
Yes, I can see that. I can see that. Because it is really, it's a false assumption.
It is.
That, given whatever characteristic that, yep. that this person is more intelligent than the other. I mean, I remember going in my teacher training, learning about, and I may be completely citing this wrong, so correct
okay.
me if I'm wrong, but the idea that on IQ scores, mm-hmm. on IQ tests, mm-hmm. black people, mm-hmm. Scored, lower
right.
than white people.
Right.
And so that was used, for so many years as like, well, mm-hmm. they're not as intelligent mm-hmm. as white people,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got scientific data here,
mm-hmm.
Until we started to realize that, okay, those tests are, biased because mm-hmm. they were made by, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Have you ever read the book, The Mismeasure of Man?
I can't say that I have. Who is it?
All right. So that's your assignment. it's called The Mismeasure, MISMEASURE, of Man. And it's written by a deceased Harvard professor named Stephen Jay Gould, G-O-U-L-D. And he actually goes back to the early development of IQ testing in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and shows how those tests, which are supposed to be, scientifically based, not mm. culturally biased, were from the very get-go based on some pre-existing or a priori assumptions about how different intellectual or different racial groups would perform. And that the people who did some of those, like, tests on 100, African-American soldiers compared to 100 white soldiers to see what their IQs looked like, they fudged the data to support the conclusion that they'd already drawn.
mm-hmm.
So IQ testing, I just think, is worthless and really worthless.
And okay. So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I am, and I don't think you know this, but I am a self-contained teacher.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, and it's surprising to most people because
Okay, nice talking to you, Tim.
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly, exactly. I have been a self-contained teacher for 10 years. When I got into working in schools, my training was so far different than what I experienced in schools.
Yeah.
And the job I got was a self-contained mm-hmm. teacher for students with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm in Georgia mm-hmm. in the same sort of situation. But now I've kind of come out of the closet. And now I can't shut up about it. And I know
yeah.
people are probably tired of me hearing, tired, especially at my school. I often have this kind of cognitive dissonance every time mm-hmm. I go to work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, and I've asked a few different, the people I interview about this. Mm-hmm. So should I quit my job as a self-contained teacher at my school and move to another school or district, because of my beliefs for inclusion, or mm-hmm. should I stay in my job and try and influence the system within? Because mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there's only so much I can control.
Mm-hmm.
I can't control who my principal is. I can't control who my mm-hmm. superintendent is or my supervisors, mm-hmm. but I can control what goes on in my classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So what would your advice be? because I'm not the only one.
Oh, gosh, no.
There's plenty of people who think and feel the same way, and they're in the same situation.
I think I would need to know more about you and to know sort of like, at the end of the day, at the end of the year,
mm-hmm.
what do you feel like you need to have done in order to feel like you've made the difference you want to make? Now, some people would say, if I feel like I change five little moments in my students' lives to give them five little slices of joy during their day,
mm-hmm.
then I will feel as if I have made enough of a difference in their life that I've held true to my own beliefs and that I think that change has made enough of a difference in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Another question I would ask you or any other teacher who's sort of pondering this dilemma is, what are the chances and have you tried to really develop a core group of allies in your school community so that you are not alone, because you'll never do it alone.
Right.
I mean, and probably even convincing one other person you convince is the principal, that person has to convince a whole bunch of other people.
Right.
So I don't know what kind of effort and resources you've sort of brought to bear to try to systematically get a group of allies. And how long can you work on that and not throw the towel in?
I don't really have an answer for the people who are in my position, except just to keep going, keep believing, keep talking. That's part of the reasons why I started this website was because I couldn't find mm-hmm. anything out there that would support mm. me.
Wow.
I could not find any resources or any teacher that was trying to do the same thing I was. And have some sort of, encouragement or, mm-hmm. saying, hey, I'm not the only one,
mm-hmm.
And so that's what I hope mm-hmm. that Think Inclusive does, that mm-hmm. these podcasts do, mm-hmm. is that the people and the teachers and the parents who listen mm-hmm. can say, okay, I'm not the only one. I can do this. Mm-hmm. I can create a professional learning network on Twitter, mm-hmm. on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I can have that support. And mm-hmm. even if I don't, get where I want to, mm-hmm. I have a roadmap,
mm-hmm.
I
just want to sort of scream when I hear that when you were teaching, you couldn't find those resources because they've been around since 1985. But those of us putting them out there haven't done a great job of it, I guess, if you, being sort of the assertive and smart and creative person you were, couldn't find those resources, what a terrible job those of us in the inclusive field have done. I'm serious, and that's a problem. We have not learned how to take, you know, these little islands of inclusive excellence and spread them. And that's another thing the Swift Project is trying to do. It's not that we've not known how to do it. It's that we've not known how to spread it on a large scale and sustain it.
Right.
So Swift is as much interested in those questions as it is on what kind of assistive technology will help this kid read better, you know.
That will do it for this episode of the Think Inclusive Podcast. Subscribe to the Think Inclusive Podcast via Apple Podcasts, the Anchor app, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Have a question or comment? Email us your feedback at podcast@thinkinclusive.us. We love to know that you were listening. Thank you to patrons Veronica E., Sonia A., Pamela P., Mark C., Kathy B., and Kathleen T. for their continued support of the podcast. When you become a patron, your contribution helps us with the cost of audio production, transcription, and promotion of the Think Inclusive Podcast. And you can even get a shout out like the fine people we just mentioned. Go to patreon.com/thinkinclusivepodcast to become a patron today and get access to all our unedited interviews, including the conversations you heard today. Thank you for helping us equip more people to promote and sustain inclusive education. This podcast is a production of MCIE, where we envision a society where neighborhood schools welcome all learners and create the foundation for inclusive communities. Learn more at mcie.org. Thanks for your time and attention. Until next time, remember, inclusion always works.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.